A friend of mine described to me how he had been fixated on the song Love and Marriage. A single hearing of the song was enough to hook him. He, quote, got trapped inside the tempo of the song, and it ran in his mind almost constantly for 10 days. With incessant repetition, it soon lost its charm. It interfered with his schoolwork, his thinking, his peace of mind, his sleep. He tried to stop it in a number of ways. He jumped up and down. He counted up to 100. He splashed water on his face. He talked loudly to himself, all to no avail.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. Physician and author Oliver Sacks has spent 40 years studying the brain. His earlier works include Awakenings and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Sacks sheds light on a host of neurological disorders, compassionately telling his patients' stories. This week, he discusses his new book, Musicophilia. Music is a uniquely human power, and Sacks says all of us are musically distinct. That's why some people perceive concerts as nothing more than the clattering of pots and pans. Others might hear the singing of a non-existent choir. Sacks tells the story of a man with Alzheimer's who cannot remember what he did even 10 minutes ago, but he remembers the baritone part to almost every song he has ever sung. Music, says Sacks, is one of the few things grounding him in the world. This discussion of musicophilia took place earlier this month at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thanks very much. It's a great pleasure being here again, although I confess I'm intimidated by your numbers and the way in which you are piled up at the back and everywhere. Now, I'm one of the less musical members of a musical family. My father was immensely musical. He used to have little miniature orchestral scores in all of his pockets, and he would look at them between patients. And he said he didn't have much use for a record player. He could play them more vividly and in more detail and in his own way, in his brain, in his mind. I'm not up to that, but I grew up in a house which was full of music, and in particular full of Bach. Apparently when I was 5, I don't remember this, but my mother told me that when I was asked what I liked most in the world, I said smoked salmon and Bach. And almost 70 years later, this is basically still the same. I had some smoked salmon at breakfast, and there's been some Bach on CDs. The Bach fascinated me doubly, both by its intricate patterns and by the fact that it was so often heartbreaking. So I thought better of music than William James, who, in the 1,500 pages of his Principles, has only a single sentence devoted to music, and that a little dismissive. He talks about musical susceptibility as having, quote, no zoological utility. It corresponds to no object in the natural environment. It is a pure incident of having a hearing organ, just so with a susceptibility to seasickness. And that's it. Well, of course, musical susceptibility does vary hugely, and I will soon speak about amusia of one degree and another. It's important to say there is no single thing such as musicality or musical susceptibility. There is no one musical center in the brain. There are 20 or 30 different systems or networks in the brain spread all over it from the frontal lobes to the back of the brain, which are involved in analyzing different aspects of music, pitch, timbre, rhythm, melodic contour, etc. And all of these can be individually heightened or lowered in different people in different conditions. All of us are musically individual and distinct. My mother was less musical in some ways, a lot less musical than my father. She had difficulty holding a tune in mind, but she adored music and she adored singing. And I feel sort of, and she loved Schubert Lieder, which she would sing in a charmingly, slightly off-key voice. But as I think that it almost brings tears to my eyes, which is not the case when I think of something which really drove me away from religion about 30 years ago. I lived on City Island in the Bronx at the time, and I went to the temple there where there was a severely, severely tone-deaf cantor. But a very ambitious one. And there are forms of cantillation in which one makes sort of elaborate tonal excursions. You go all over the place and there are little turns and then you sort of come back, or you should come back, to the sort of tonal center, get home. But if he came back at all, it would be half an octave away. And I think one day, with an expression probably like that of Münch's scream, I sort of exited and never returned. Now maybe 5 or 10% of the population, they may love music, they may sing, but they have some degree of tone deafness. But this is quite different from real amusia. And I first encountered this with a colleague, a distinguished French neurologist called Lhermitte. And he said to me that when he listened to music, he could either say it was the Marseillaise or it wasn't. That was it. And unfortunately, I forgot to ask him how he knew it was the Marseillaise. I mean, I suspect it was because people saluted or came to attention or something like this. So that is the real thing. And a few months ago, I saw and I write about it at length in the book, a charming woman, Dolores, who lived in the Bronx. And she described how from her earliest memories, she realized there was a difference from other people. When other children, when she was 5, the children were asked to sing their names. She couldn't do it, and she really didn't know what was going on and why people were making peculiar faces. Then there was a music recognition class, William Tell Overture and other pieces. She couldn't recognize any of them. In fact, she couldn't distinguish them. She says her father got a Victrola gramophone, you know, tried to train her, but it didn't work. A family friend tested her a little bit and found that she had the greatest difficulty telling whether one note was higher or lower than another, even if they were far apart. And so, really, with Dolores, she can't hear tones or semitones. She doesn't have the building blocks for hearing music, for hearing a scale. But she said she was very curious and wistful because she would see that everyone around her, you know, listened attentively and apparently derived a lot of feeling. And so she would go to concerts with boyfriends and to musicals and then with her husband. But this really didn't work. And she said the experience was somewhere between unintelligible and excruciating. When I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "If you were to go into the kitchen and throw all the pots and pans on the floor, that's what I hear with what you call music." In the late 90s, she saw an article in the New York Times about a team in Montreal, which was apparently investigating such a condition. And she got in touch with them, and they came down, they investigated her, and in a way they reassured her. She had come from a rather musical family, and her mother always said, "What have you got against music?" But the people in Montreal said, "No, you have congenital amusia. This is a neurological condition. You don't have anything against music. You have a little part missing in the right frontal lobe, and that's why you can't do it." she said, "Are there others like me?" And they said, "A few." And they introduced us to some of her brothers and sisters in Amusia. And they also said to her, "You don't have to go to concerts anymore." And she said she wished that had been said to her when she was 7 rather than 70. I should say, that this woman has really had a very full life. In other ways, she is a teacher. Her perception of speech and indeed her enjoyment of theatre and poetry is really unimpaired, which is very interesting. That one can perceive speech perfectly well, even if one is deaf to music. And although she is still a little curious, she says she would occasionally have fantasies of suddenly hearing music. But she said she imagined it would be like being totally colorblind and suddenly seeing color. And really, she couldn't actually imagine it. Amusia. Now, I've mentioned that a little bit of the brain was different in her, and that many parts of the brain are recruited for perceiving music. And many parts of the brain respond to musical experience, and especially musical training. I don't mean the Mozart effect. I don't mean a little Mozart under the pillow. That's useless. I mean, it's okay, it's nice, it's fine, but it doesn't actually do anything for one. But intensive musical training does. And there have been some fascinating studies comparing the brains of musicians and non-musicians. A very good man called Schlaug, Gottfried Schlaug, has been doing this in Boston. And the differences, he thought there might be slight differences. You know, there's been a huge amount of work, say, on Einstein's brain, which was actually pinched at autopsy by the pathologist and cut up into small pieces. People have been looking with some success over the years, and they found some small changes which might be characteristic. But the changes in musicians' brains are not small. They are large and even visible to the naked eye. The corpus callosum, the big band of white matter between the cerebral hemispheres, it tends to be enlarged, and you find enlargement of gray matter, of the nerve cells, in the auditory parts of the brain, but also visual parts of the brain, in the frontal lobes, and in motor parts of the brain, and primitive parts of the brain, like the cerebellum and basal ganglia. And so although you can't look at a brain and say, this is the brain of a mathematician or a visual artist, you can look at a brain and say, this is probably the brain of a musician. Now, one might say, how much is this innate and how much is it a result of training? This is less easy to say, but there have been studies with, say, a year of intensive training, like the Suzuki training, and this will show, even in a year, visible changes. And there's some suggestion that training of this sort in children may help them read and spread into other cognitive powers. Although I really shouldn't speak of this too much, because I really should just speak of my own experiences, which are with patients, and mostly, but not exclusively, fairly elderly patients. Once the musical system, once these networks are set up, they are very robust, and they tend to survive all sorts of insults to the brain, strokes, head injuries, and dementia, not least. And I think I want to read you a little bit from a letter I received. Incidentally, in the book, I have 162 acknowledgements to correspondents. I have really only a tiny practice in New York, but people write me letters. I've actually been getting something like, nearly 100 a day. It's overwhelming at the moment. But some of them interest me deeply, and then I will write back to the people, and perhaps we will meet later. One such letter came from a lady who said that her father had Alzheimer's for 13 years. She said it's invaded a large amount of his brain. He can't remember much of anything about his life. However, he remembers the baritone part to almost every song he has ever sung. He has performed with a 12-man a cappella group for almost 40 years. Music is one of the only things that keeps him grounded in the world. He has no idea what he did for a living, where he is living now, or what he did 10 minutes ago. Almost every memory is gone except for the music. And she described how he was still able to perform with his group at a professional level. The evening he performed, he had no idea how to tie a tie. Well, I'm not so good at that. He got lost on his way to the stage, but the performance, perfect. Now, and then a few weeks later, I met him and his wife and daughter. He was a very charming, civil man. I asked him how he was, and his answer reminded me a little bit of what was described with Emerson, who became demented in his early 60s. When Emerson was asked how he was, he would say, "Quite well. I've lost my mental faculties, but I'm perfectly well." You know, one wishes that, you know, in this time of, shame and stigma and wretchedness and mortification, which tend to go with Alzheimer's, that this sort of good humour and serenity could also surround it. Woody Geist, he was carrying a very neatly furled New York Times. And all that looked normal, though in fact he didn't know what a New York Times was, he didn't know what a newspaper was, but the behaviour of carrying a neatly furled newspaper was there. This showed itself in some other ways. He'd been a good tennis player. He didn't know the word tennis racket. He couldn't recognise a tennis racket, but if he were put on a court and a racket put in his hand and a ball came towards him, he would be activated and do a really mean shot backwards. So in a way, this was a man who had lost the memory of events, of experiences. In some sense, he'd lost his autobiography. He'd lost a lot of knowledge of all sorts of knowledge. But procedures and performances, whether it was singing or tennis or holding a New York Times, were all there. And this brought out very clearly that people have different sorts of memory. I've seen this even more strikingly, and I wrote about it as one of the pieces in the book, with a very gifted musician, Clive Waring, who had an encephalitis and became amnesiac. Clive remembers nothing for more than a few seconds. A recent video was made of him called The Man with a 7-Second Memory, but he's not only able to play and sing, he's able to conduct a choir, an orchestra, perfectly. And this is because this sort of memory, the ability to perform, procedural memory, as psychologists call it, is really vested in lower parts of the brain, and the cerebellum and the basal ganglia. You use your cortex to learn, and then you repeat, and with repetition, the performance, the action patterns, along with all of the intelligence and sensibility built into them, is safeguarded in the lower parts of the brain. This can occur with other things but music. I recently saw a very gifted actor with amnesia, but his consummate acting skills and his whole Shakespearean repertoire are there, and he is still doing things professionally. So acquire skills and repertoires while you can, because they will not only be useful on a desert island or in prison, but if you become senile. And at 74, this is a thought which is often in my mind. I'm not watching the time, I should. Dementia. Woody, of course, was musically very gifted, but in fact almost all people with Alzheimer's or dementia, even if they have sunk very deep and no longer comprehend language or most other things, nonetheless they will respond to music, especially to songs and familiar songs. And not only will they light up when they hear the song, but they light up because the song brings back with it memories, associations, moods, which they have no access to otherwise. People regain their past and their identity briefly and for a while with songs, if they have Alzheimer's. With people who have Parkinson's, and this is where my own interest as a physician started, with the patients who I later described in Awakenings, with very severe Parkinson's, people are almost transfixed. They can be frozen, unable to initiate movement or speech. But with music, they'll dance, they'll sing, they'll flow. Music gives them the ability to move, which they don't have at other times. And I think part of the reason for this is that human beings uniquely have all sorts of connections between auditory and motor systems, so that every child from the age of 2 on will respond to music, will keep time, will dance, either imagined music or heard music. You don't see a chimpanzee dancing. Chimpanzees can't dance. But this business of being synchronized to music, to the beat, I think is crucial in all sorts of ways. It's crucial in bonding. It probably appeared very early in evolution. It has no analog in speech. It seems to be a primordial musical power which appears in children, which has special anatomical correlates in the brain, and which is vital for, say, people with Parkinson's. So there are all sorts of, beside the good powers of music, which all of us have, which Barbara was referring to sort of to rouse, to calm, to comfort. You know, one thinks of sort of Saul and David in the Bible. Music can be absolutely crucial for people with various neurological conditions. This includes aphasia, when through a stroke or something, people have lost language and lost speech. But even aphasic people are usually able to sing, often to their own surprise, and not only able to get a tune, but to get the words of happy birthday or whatever. And this in itself is very reassuring, because it shows them that language is there, even if it's apparently embedded or locked in music. And the challenge then is to see whether one can disembed it and free it and make it available for ordinary speech use. At first it seemed that this was not possible, but it is possible, although it needs a lot of work and a lot of motivation. Intriguingly, it's possible even if one has massive damage in the left hemisphere of the brain, where the speech and language areas normally are. It's amazing that, in fact, the right hemisphere of the brain, which is normally mute and has other functions, can, in fact, become a substrate for language. It's a remarkable example of the plasticity of the brain, which one sees in all sorts of ways. Something which I think all of us have are both in a pleasant way and a not-so-pleasant and rather pathological way, is music which runs through the head. And even people, say, like my mother, who could not easily summon a tune on command or voluntarily, she would often have music which ran through the head. Most of the music which runs through one's head has reference to something one has heard recently, or to one's feelings, or one's mood, or what one is doing. And it's an intriguing accompaniment of life. It can be very strong among other people in athletes, in cyclists and runners and others who have rhythmic motions, and if they don't have an actual iPod, they may really make use of a sort of mental iPod. For myself, I'm a swimmer, and in the 1-2-3 of freestyle, I find myself insensibly falling into a waltz time. I mean, basically, I swim to Strauss. However, this sort of normal and often invigorating and emotionally emotionally appropriate music can sometimes go wrong, and instead one can have music which goes on maddeningly and mechanically and loses all connection with everything. A friend of mine who may be here. Hello, Nick. Well, we'll see. I thought 20 people called Nick might answer. Well, he lives here. A friend of mine, Nick Eunice, described to me how he had been fixated on the song Love and Marriage, a tune written by James Van Heusen. A single hearing of the song, a Frank Sinatra rendition used as the theme song of the television show Married with Children. Incidentally, he didn't see the show, it was just the theme song. A single hearing was enough to hook him. He, quote, got trapped inside the tempo of the song, and it ran in his mind almost constantly for 10 days. With incessant repetition, it soon lost its charm, its lilt, its musicality, and its meaning. It interfered with his schoolwork, his thinking, his peace of mind, his sleep. He tried to stop it in a number of ways. He jumped up and down. He counted up to 100. He splashed water on his face. He talked loudly to himself, all to no avail. And then it faded after a few days. But when he described this to me, it came back. And lasted. So I think all of us have had these things. They're usually not entire tunes. They're usually fragments. And there's a reason for this, which goes really with the nature of short-term memory and attention on music. The fragments may last about 20 seconds, and they may go round and round and round and round. People have to find ways of stopping these if they can. One way may be just to complete the song, so it's not just going round fragmentarily in a little loop. Well, all of us, I think, have these, and maybe we're going to be more and more apt to have them. Now, music, which used to be rare and precious, is unavoidable and ubiquitous. You can't go into, perhaps you can go into a bookshop, but in general, you can't go into a restaurant or a bar or a mall or a gym and not be assaulted by music, which is not of your choosing. And of course, people are plugged into iPods all the while. I don't know how it is in Washington, but in New York, roughly speaking, 90% of the people either have cell phones or iPods. And they not only look as if they're hallucinating. In effect, they are, because they're completely engrossed in their own world, and they walk in front of one's car or bicycle. I have a grudge against this, because such a person walked in front of me when I was cycling, and I went over the handlebars. I did everything, including, I have a very loud klaxon on my bike, and I have a police whistle. Didn't work. Now, something which I think I'm going to finish here, something which is a lot rarer, and only some people have it, are musical hallucinations. And again, I'm going to introduce these with a letter. From June B. She said, things started last November when I was visiting my sister and brother-in-law one night. After turning off the TV and preparing to retire, I started hearing Amazing Grace. It was being sung by a choir over and over again. I checked with my sister to see if they had some church service on TV, but they had Monday Night Football or some such. So I went onto the deck overlooking the water. The music followed me. I looked down on the quiet coastline and the few houses with lights, and realized that the music couldn't possibly be coming from anywhere in that area. It had to be in my head. This is a sort of sequence which everyone will go through with hallucinations. Hallucinations are not like imagery. They are just like perception. They are indistinguishable from perception. And so you have to look... You hear that? No. I've seen people hallucinate like this. They have a startled look on their face. They look around. They try and locate it. Do you hear it? And then when they can't find an external source, like June, they have to say, it had to be in my head. Often one associates hearing things in the popular mind, and the medical mind for that matter, with being psychotic, with voices. These are nothing like voices, psychologically or neurologically. About 80 or 90% of the people who have them are fairly deaf. And it's as if sometimes, it's as if when the auditory parts of the brain are not getting their proper input, their proper nourishment, then they may start to generate activity on their own. There are similar things with people often who are visually impaired. They may start to have visual hallucinations, see animals and so forth. June enclosed what she called her playlist. She started with Amazing Grace, and then other things happen. Another correspondent wrote to me, and he talked about his intracranial jukebox, which had about 20 selections, all of them from early life. He could not stop the jukebox. People can't stop the hallucinations, but they can often switch them to another tune which has some similarities of rhythm or theme or mood or whatever. Anyhow, with June B., her playlist, beside Amazing Grace, included the Battle Hymn of the Republic, Beethoven's Ode to Joy, the drinking song from La Traviata, a Tisket a Tasket, and what she called a really dreary version of We Three Kings of Orient Are. And she went on to say, one night I heard a splendidly solemn rendition of Old MacDonald Had a Farm, followed by thunderous applause. At that moment I decided that as I was obviously completely bonkers, I better have the matter looked into. Well, she did have it looked into. She'd heard that Lyme disease could produce musical hallucinations, that taking too much aspirin could, and a little stroke could, but basically the cause could not be found with her. I've seen her again recently. 10 years have passed. She still has them, but they're milder. They don't wake her at night, and she's sort of learned to live with them. And as with anything chronic, I said, would you like to be rid of them? And she hesitated. She said, I'd miss them. I'd miss them. But they can be very unpleasant. With one patient of mine who had hallucinations, he'd been born in Germany in the 1920s. First of all, he heard what he called slushy German lullabies, but then he heard Nazi marching songs, and this horrified him. He'd been a boy growing up in Hamburg in the 1930s and sort of haunted by the Hitlerjugend, but then fortunately the Nazi marching songs disappeared. And after that, he started to hear bits of Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. This was not to his taste either. Quote, too noisy, emotional, rhapsodic. When I asked him about his hallucinations, I said, what are they like? He used an odd choice of adjectives. He said tonal and corny. And then he explained that his wife was an eminent composer of atonal music, and these were what his own tastes were. On the whole, the hallucinations occur in older people, but not invariably. I saw one 9-year-old, and by description, he'd started having them when he was much younger. His father said that when he was 4 or 5, sometimes sitting in the back seat of the car, he'd scream and block his ears and ask his father to turn off the car radio when it wasn't on. I think I more or less have to stop here. I will say that there are 29 sections in my book, and I've only made reference to 4 or 5 of them. I'd be happy to speak about the other 23 or 24 with regard to absolute pitch or synesthesia or musical savants or what you will, but I'm going to leave that to you, and meanwhile thank you for your attention and coming.
There was a survey taken some years ago about what the author called nature and mystical experience. For example, blissful feelings and out in nature. And one of the main triggers they found out was music. You know, as T.S. Eliot says, music heard so deeply, you are the music while the music lasts.
Yes.
And I was wondering what is in the brain can tap so deeply into us that we are so transported out of ourselves.
Schopenhauer, you know, wrote a famous chapter about this and about the paradox of music, that it doesn't represent anything external, but it can tear one's heart in two, and it can produce states of mind and emotions unimaginable anywhere else. I had a little bit of this afternoon when I heard a fragment of the opera Yenufa, and actually the hairs rose on my forearm. I was quite overwhelmed. Studies have been done using functional brain imagery, because one can look at the brain in real time as people are listening to music or imagining or hallucinating it or composing it or responding emotionally to it. And one finds that very deep parts of the brain are activated, the same parts of the brain as are activated in love, in orgasm, with various drugs, and so forth. I find myself thinking of this De Quincey phrase about the pressure on the heart of the incommunicable. The human nervous system uniquely is equipped for dealing with very rapid, complex, segmented streams of sound, whether they are music or speech, and of course for producing them. The limit of the communicable by language seems to be expanded by music. Music is much better than language at communicating the ineffable, whatever the ineffable is, and you know, and the mystical, and we really don't know how it does it, but it clearly does.
Thank you very much.
My question has to do with musical memory. I know you're interested in memory, and so it's slightly skewed from the topics in your book here, but what has always amazed me is someone like, I believe it was Alfred Brendel, in a three-day concert, played all 32 of Beethoven's sonatas. That's about 850 pages of music, plus probably maybe 15 or 20 concertos and all other music. These musicians, I assume that you've interviewed many of them, when they memorize this type of music, is it something that's just in their brain and goes from their brain to their fingers, or in their mind's eye, do they actually see sheet music that they can read off of?
I think there are individual differences. I've spoken to performers who, in fact, see the music visually, but others don't, and one certainly doesn't have to. The sort of memory involved with performance has involved incessant repetition and rehearsal, and it's in the fingers. Is procedural memory, and in a way procedural memory has almost no limits, and it is fluent and it is automatic. This doesn't mean that it's mechanical. I mean, it's procedural memory which in pre-literate cultures allows entire sagas, sort of the Eddas or Homer or whatever, to be recited. And this is one of the things which is especially developed in musicians. It used to be, in a generation before me, people had to learn a great deal by heart. I think it's rather a pity that this has gone, because this comes back to the business of what stays in the mind forever. It's all there for a Brendel. For myself, in a minor way, I play the piano a bit, but as soon as I think of a piece, I find my hands immediately falling into the position, and as if my hands know it. But this is the nature of procedural memory.
Thank you.
My son is a person who stutters, and he started a theater company for young people who stutter in New York. Uh-huh. what's fascinating, watching the kids perform or even come out to say their names. It might take them 10 minutes to get their name or to say welcome, you know, to the audience. But they write all their own words and they write their own songs. And you can watch one kid who might take 10 minutes to speak, to say their name or to say a line in the play they wrote. But as soon as they start to sing, there is not 1 ounce of hesitation or stutter. And it's just astounding to me to watch the difference as soon as the music comes on.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, whenever people can't say their name, you must ask them to sing their name.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they're not shy. Yeah, I think this has some similarities. You know, sometimes Parkinsonism has been called a kinetic stutter. When if people aren't frozen, they may make little tiny movements. And they gain fluency and fluidity and flow with music. And they're probably rather similar mechanisms involved. With music and with musical language, so with recitation or prayer or whatever, with language which is intoned. Yeah.
I'm a mathematician and I play the cello, and people say, no wonder. Do you find there is a correlation? I personally don't believe there's a correlation between music and mathematics, but people always say there is.
Right. Well, although there may be a number of mathematical cellists, there may be, I think, an equal number of mathematicians who are not musicians and vice versa. Beethoven was notoriously sort of unmathematical, and yet, you know, one's inclined to think one is dealing with complex patterns, with proportions, with symmetries. There's a fascinating book by Victor Weisskopf, who was a great theoretical physicist, mathematician, but also a very good amateur musician. There's a chapter in his autobiography called Mozart and Quantum Mechanics, in which he compares the skills and the joys and the beauties and feels that the differences are greater than the similarities. But one can certainly sort of argue it all ways and be happy to have both.
You make a very strong case that music is very deeply ingrained, and you speak about how essentially it's the last thing to go in many cases, and you also talk about procedural memory. I wonder if you've speculated at all to yourself, or would care to speculate to us, the extent to which this might have some sort of survival advantage.
Well, of course, you know, this comes back to the William James quote where he says of no zoological utility, and echoed by Steven Pinker, who will speak of music as auditory cheesecake, and you know, and say again, you know, if music disappeared from life, it wouldn't make any difference. I mean, one can think of roles and values which music has. One of them, I think, is with rhythm and synchronization to rhythm, that this will lead to all sorts of group behavior and group synchronization, which you have to have in society at every level. Another may be the fact that, Darwin has a whole chapter about music and his Descent of Man and in relation to sexual selection, and he felt that music and singing was important in courtship and in all of the behaviors of this sort. And certainly, I think sometimes musicians and especially young singers, you know, are regarded as especially attractive in our culture. But the fact, but beyond this, it does seem that music provides modes and ways of expression and communication which nothing else can. I mean, the three things which seem to be uniquely human, at least in their development, are language, music, and mimicry. And music seems to be able to convey things which neither language nor mimicry can, and presumably this would have some selective power. But I you know, I'm not very good at speculation. I mostly, you know, I just listen to my patient stories and tell them.
My question actually goes is highlighted a little bit by your last comment, because I was going to say that we share music with other species, obviously. So, for example, there are birds in New Zealand that learn and store up to 200 different tunes and will mimic you as you go down the trail if you whistle a tune. And I'm wondering whether there's been any neurological study of other animals with regard to their response to music.
Yeah, I knew birds would come up. I should have said that, you know, human beings are unique among mammals, possibly. We used to speak rather derisively of bird brains, but in the last few years there has been a tremendous appreciation of how much that 10 grams of brain can do, and of avian neurology and psychology. And as you say, with some birds, there can be a huge repertoire of songs, quote unquote. Although I think these songs are more like musical codes or calls, and they are relatively stereotyped, and they're not sort of variously expressive and modulable in the same sense as language. Of course, there are also whale calls or whale music, which is sometimes down in the infrasonic range and may take hours. It's recently been found that mice have a sort of rather high ultrasonic codes, and elephants. But I don't know whether any of this is really comparable to human music. And in a sense, I do think of music as exclusively human.
In your chapter on Parkinson's, you mentioned that the you mentioned that the right kind of music helps a person, and by that I assume it means that everybody's individual. How do you go about finding that right kind of music for a certain for a specific person?
Obviously there is no general music, and all music is individual. But having said that, the music which is essential for people with Parkinson's has to have a well-marked but not overwhelming rhythm. And this probably to do with the fact that it is rhythm which elicits movement and which one synchronizes with. The music doesn't have to be familiar or even liked, although it helps if it is. Whereas, say, with Alzheimer's, it does have to be familiar and liked.
Like in Awakenings, the response would just be automatic when you play the music.
Well, it depends what one means by automatic. I mean, one is not rigidly moving in time with the music. In Parkinson's, the part of the brain which are especially involved are the basal ganglia, which are necessary for temporal order and successive actions and for the sense of time and flow. And music seems to act as a sort of template for that, almost as a sort of prosthesis for the basal ganglia, so it allows movement without enforcing it.
As you were talking about amusia, I was thinking about your bringing about the different features of music, the tone, the contours, the rhythm, and all these things, and I thought to some degree that that sort of mirrors what happens with a disorder like protopagnosia, where the different features of the face can't be perceived and put together into a unifying whole. I was just wondering what kind of ramifications something like amusia would have in terms of our understanding of the brain as a pattern recognizer.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, one would say, imagine that one is just given the visual world as a whole, full of sort of color and movement and depth and pattern and luminosity, and you have to find people who can't perceive color, can't perceive faces, can't perceive depth, can't perceive movement, to realize that all of these things are separate, independent mechanisms which have to be orchestrated all together. And it's similar with music, possibly more complex, and they're like 20 forms of amusia. I really only refer to one of them. And this brings up that music is just a hugely complex construct, and also that we all do it in different ways. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for listening. For more discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.
Thank you.